Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. A note to people calling in right now. We have only one person screening calls today, and this is going to go on for a while. We usually have two or three in normal times, but obviously we're trying to have as few people as possible go into the studios. So for one thing, when we are taking calls, please understand if the screener is moving fast to let you go after a segment ends, or if we can't take your call within a segment, they'll just say that we can't take your call for this segment. We have too many calls, whatever it is. And they will have to move on quickly, and they're not being rude. We just have one screener for all the people who are calling in at any one time under these circumstances. And for this moment, our segment with Senator Gillibrand is over. And I think a lot of people are still calling, hoping to talk to Senator Gillibrand. So for anybody who's still on hold right now or anybody calling in, no calls right at this moment. We'll invite calls for our next guest as we go and we get to the caller topic relevant to him. But thank you for understanding, callers. If you're on hold now, why don't you drop off or don't call in right now because we don't have an active caller question at this second. Thank you so much. With us now, former head of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Richard Besser, who has also been the ABC News Chief Health and Medical Editor. He is currently president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, leading the largest private foundation in the country devoted solely to improving the nation's health. When Richard Besser ran the CDC as acting director in 2009, he directed the U.S. response to the H1N1 influenza pandemic, so he obviously has experience very relevant to today. Dr. Besser, welcome, and thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. Really, really great to be here this morning.
So you wrote in the Washington Post as head of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a pretty candid op-ed, candid about something that maybe you did wrong a decade ago, saying that when you were head of the CDC during H1N1, you called for schools to close for 2 weeks, but other people had to educate you about a blind spot in that recommendation. Would you like to tell that story?
Yeah, I would. I do think it's extremely relevant to what's going on now. So I led the CDC back in 2009, and the CDC is the nation's public health agency and very science-based, focused on what guidance would we feel would protect people the most. And it was clear that with influenza, with the flu, children play a very important role. And so we put forward a recommendation based on science that with the first case of flu or suspected flu in a school, the school should close for 2 weeks so that there wouldn't be further transmission, the school could be cleaned, there could be further testing and separation. And we went forward with that guidance, and I very quickly started to hear from public health leaders in the field. And they said, you know, you put up these guidance for social distancing to keep kids away from each other, but it's not working. Parents need to go to work. They need food. They need money to put food on the table. They need money to pay rent. And so instead of their kids staying home, they're dropping them off at the mall or at a community center or at the library. He said, your recommendations are nuts. And what it struck me and what struck me here during this guidance is that we spend so much time talking about what are the recommended things to do, and we don't spend enough time talking about what will it take so that everyone in America can do the things that we think could help protect those people who are most vulnerable for getting coronavirus.
So how do you see that playing out in inequality terms or effectiveness in fighting the inequality terms today with schools closed in so much of the country?
Yeah, I mean, the point that we made in the op-ed piece is that this is a country of haves and have-nots. And so many people in America live paycheck to paycheck, don't earn a living wage, don't have wealth or income saved. And so closing schools, you're forcing people to make a decision. Do they go to work and get money so that they can take care of their families. We've heard some of your listeners who are worried about being evicted, about not being able to pay rent. Do you go to work and get money to pay rent, or do you do those things that you know will help protect yourself, your families, and your community, and that's staying home. You know, thankfully, we're seeing action in Washington to try and address some of those issues. But these are short-term fixes to issues that should be long-term policy changes. It shouldn't be an emergency that requires us or takes us to the point where we're addressing some of these structural societal issues.
And here's an indication of that inequality. Of course, everyone from nurses and cops and Amazon workers to Boris Johnson today are getting it. But we saw an unemployment survey in New York City this week done by the City University that found 29% of New York City households now have someone who is unemployed, but it's 34% in households making less than $50,000 a year and 41% among Latino households, which of course skew lower income than white households. Good indication of the crisis hitting unequally?
I think so. With every public health emergency, you see lower income communities, communities of color, rural communities, Native American communities, all being hit harder. And then certain populations, the elderly, people with disabilities, they tend to get hit hardest during public health crises because the systems aren't there at a baseline to ensure that people can provide for the basics in their lives.
How far do you think the $2 trillion relief bill goes then to close that inequality gap in the short run for this crisis in the ways you argued for in your article?
Well, we'll see when the final bill is passed what's in there and where the gaps remain. A couple things that concern me, the issue of eviction and foreclosure and cutting off of utilities. We're seeing state-by-state activity in that regard, but most states haven't put forward a moratorium on cutting off utilities. So imagine what it's like. You're closing schools, and so children are staying home. And for some families, they're seeing their gas, their electricity, their water shut off. So you can't give your kid a bath or give them water to drink. Those things shouldn't be taking place during a crisis. They shouldn't be taking place every day, but there should definitely be moratoria on that. New York has done that, but most states have not taken that action yet.
Now, listeners, we can invite some phone calls for our current guest, Dr. Richard Besser, former head of the Centers for Disease Control, now president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is public health oriented, at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we do have a caller relevant to you, and that is Mark in Queens. Mark, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a pretty urgent question right now coming from Queens, which is arguably the epicenter right now. You know, a couple of weeks ago, everybody was talking about testing, testing, testing. That's all you heard the mayor talk about, the governor. Now you're hearing people crowding hospitals, trying to get in and find out if they have it. So my question is, if people think they have it in New York City or anywhere, what are, they're telling people contact your healthcare provider, but we need a general answer from the governor or the mayor informing us, what do people do if they think they have it? Should you stay home and rest, or should you seek testing? I don't think the people know the answer to that right now. We have family members who think they have it, so we're just looking to get an answer.
Dr. Besser, how can you advise Mark?
I think it's a great question. It comes back, Brian, to the point of making recommendations without ensuring that everyone can follow those recommendations means that we're going to fail. There are 28 million people in America without health insurance, and so telling people to call their doctor if they're sick really doesn't play out for those people. Thankfully, there is a lot of information online. The CDC has a symptom checker that can help you decide, are the symptoms that you have severe enough that you should go into an emergency room, or are they things that you can handle at home? I hope that there are things coming forward in bills that will provide for full payment to community health centers for telemedicine, so that it's not just people of means who are able to call their doctor and have an appointment at home, but everyone can do that. One thing that is true with every outbreak, with every pandemic, it's an evolving situation. So as more and more testing becomes available, what we're going to see is changing in terms of who it's recommended get those tests. Right now, it's essential that those tests are available for people who are the sickest, so that doctors can decide, okay, this person has COVID or this person has something else. We don't want to put them on a ward where people have that disease. We want to be able to treat what they truly have. We want to have enough tests for healthcare providers and other people who work in healthcare systems to know if they're sick. But in terms of long-term approach to this, it's going to change dramatically when there is sufficient testing to be able to say how much disease is in a community, how much is no longer there, how many people in the community had this and didn't know it, but now are potentially protected because of their immune response. It's going to change. And so staying abreast of what those changes are and what's recommended is important.
We'll continue in a minute with Dr. Besser, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. On WNYC, as we continue with Dr. Richard Besser, who is president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. He was the acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and the ABC News chief health and medical editor. And David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. David, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Doctor, I appreciate your time, and I hope you and your family, all of you, are both safe and sound in this crisis. I have two questions, one question and one concern that also is going through my mind. The first is, you know, I have asthma, and I've seen that a lot of people that have breathing problems are higher at risk, like people that have cancer and other diseases. How can I protect myself if I am outside, not to get it, even despite that I actually go and, you know, wash my hands on a regular basis? That's the first part. The other part is, I know that time is limited. I've read, you know, documentaries from outside of the United States saying that in China, the reason why it spread so fast is because the people were saying it went through the pipes, that actually when people were drinking water or otherwise, that's how it was able to spread so fast, more than the contagion of people actually just having close contact. So how would you elaborate on that, Doctor?
David, thank you. Doctor, can you help David with either of those questions?
Yeah, thanks, David. You know, we're going to learn more over time in terms of more specifics of what groups and what conditions put you at greatest risk. But for you with asthma, I think following the recommendations in terms of when you're outside, trying to keep 6 feet distance from other people and good hand washing, those things will protect you as well as everyone else. You know, there have been some conversation about exercise, and exercise is really important, not just for physical health, but also emotional and mental health. So being able to exercise safely where you're keeping away from people, that's really important for you with asthma as well. In terms of the transmission in China, there's really no evidence that this disease transmits through water, through pipes. The reason it's felt that it has been able to spread so easily is that it's highly contagious, and it can likely be spread by people before they have symptoms, or some people perhaps who don't have symptoms at all. So that allows it to enter a community and spread without being able to just take the approach of isolating people who have symptoms.
David, good luck. Stay safe. I hope that's helpful. Doctor, I see you've complained on Twitter that the Centers for Disease Control, which you used to run, has been sidelined from a public role. You wrote, "We need to know that policy decisions are informed by the CDC, the nation's public health agency, and that the CDC is leading the public health response. This would inspire trust, and trust is critical for action. Bring back the CDC daily briefing." So has the CDC been sidelined?
Well, you know, I led emergency response at CDC for 4 years, and what I found during every response, and what I found in particular during the 2009 H1N1 response, is that if you want people to follow your recommendations, there has to be trust. And you get trust by being transparent, by being clear about what you know and what you don't know and what you're doing to get answers, by hearing from the world's best experts in responding to a pandemic, and that's the leaders, the scientists at the CDC. We need to hear from them directly. And yes, in the end, things are a policy decision, and that's made by people who we elect. But you want to know that what they're deciding is based on science, and then you want to know the options that they had and why they took a particular course. Right now, we're not hearing directly from the CDC. During Zika, during the Zika crisis, we heard every day from Dr. Ann Shook at the CDC, and she explained what was being done. And then there were policy decisions made that may counter what CDC was recommending, but at least you understood that. And right now, it's very hard to know the discussions about reopening communities and when that should take place. How much is based on public health science and how much is based on politics?
Do you think we're not getting enough of the public health perspective on that from the two public health officials who are in just about all the president's daily briefings, Dr. Deborah Birx, with her long background in HIV and global health diplomacy, first appointed by President Obama, and the legendary Dr. Anthony Fauci?
Yeah, I know Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci, and they are both terrific. They're both excellent scientists. I remember during H1N1, Dr. Fauci and I would stand side by side, and he would be talking about the development of vaccines and medications and what we were learning about the virus and transmission and all of the science. And I would talk about the public health response and what the public could do and how we were understanding its movement through communities. We're not hearing directly from the people at CDC. I'm hoping that their information is filtering up through the task force, but I would feel much better if instead of having briefings that were kicking off with a political briefing, we were seeing briefings that were the lead scientists from CDC, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, all together talking about this. And then hearing from the political leaders in terms of what they wanted to do in response to what was going on. There was a lot of work being done to study this. And in every pandemic, in every outbreak, it's learn as you go, adapt as you go. And we need to know what's being learned and how that may change what we decide to do.
Mike in Flatbush, you're on WNYC with Dr. Richard Besser. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Doctor. Hi, Brian. My question has to do with testing for coronavirus. Dr. Fauci said that years ago there was a decision made in CDC to find a test for coronavirus, but it was abandoned. And I wondered if you knew about that and do you agree with that assessment? Because testing kits are badly needed, like ventilators and masks.
Thank you, Mike. Dr. Besser?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. One of the things that CDC does is develop rapid testing when there's a new infectious agent that emerges. It's one of the things that CDC labs have done across their history. Coronaviruses include a wide variety of different viruses. And so this is a new virus. It's a novel virus. That's why it's called novel coronavirus 19. And so a new test that was specific to this agent had to be developed. There are a lot of tests for different types of coronaviruses, but they needed to develop a new one that would let us know if someone had this new SARS-CoV-2, it's called.
Mike, thank you very much. We're almost out of time. You also tweeted yesterday an article by the former head of the CDC, Dr. Thomas Friedan. You said the big takeaway from his piece is that the choice is not between health and economics, but about optimizing the public health response to save lives while minimizing economic harm. And I'm curious how that informs your view of what the president's team is considering now, letting some parts of the U.S. go back to work on a county-by-county basis, depending on the prevalence of the virus there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the notion of selectively opening the economy is an important thing to discuss, because when you look at the economic hardship and who it's hitting people on the margins the hardest. And you want to ensure that you're able to get people back to work as soon as it's safe to do so. Now is not the time for that. we don't have enough testing to know how disease is spreading through communities. We don't have enough equipment for hospitals to take care of people if cases were to increase. But there will come a time when we're able to track a disease through a community. We'll know how much has come through, and we'll know that it's okay to lighten up the controls. We'll also understand better through studies that are being done how much transmission is done by children. If it turns out that children aren't really important in terms of transition, we might be able to think about opening schools sooner. So it's a learn as you go, and we need to know the science and the questions that are being asked and how they're being answered in order to decide when the right time is to lighten up the social distancing. But now is not the time to do that.
So let's end on a question about transmission. I assume they're learning more every day about coughing or sneezing on people, or just walking by within 6 feet, or how much on hard surfaces, how much, if at all, on delivery boxes. Do you have a take on what to be afraid of and what not to be afraid of that might be different than what anybody was saying a week ago?
Well, there are a lot of studies being done to look at that, and you'll hear about the virus being found on surfaces and different distances, and one of the things that's being looked at is, okay, if you find it on the surface, that means it's there, but what role, how important is that in terms of transmission? I think if people focus on those things that we know are of concern, so the 6 feet in terms of social distancing, covering coughs and sneezes, paying particular attention to cleaning your hands, those things will help a lot. As more is known, if there's additional precautions people should take, then let's start to do those. But you can go over the moon in terms of trying to sterilize your world because of concern of where this virus is. If we can all focus on helping everyone do the things that we really think will work, We are as a society going to be more successful here. And it's great to see communities pulling together to try and ensure that everyone has that fair opportunity to protect themselves, their families, and community.
Dr. Richard Besser, CEO and President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, formerly the head of the Centers for Disease Control and the ABC News Chief Health and Medical Editor. Thank you so much for your time and information.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk about how your isolated elderly relatives, or you if you're that isolated elderly relative, can stay connected. Stay with us.